What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Tova Mervis, award-winning writer and author of the new memoir, The Book of Separation. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Too Jewish Mevinah in Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinchinim, Chen Denachi and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. This Friday night, we begin the great Festival of Freedom, Passover, most observed Jewish holiday today. Pesach is special in unique ways, even in its name. Actually, the holiday has no fewer than four official names in Jewish tradition. Pesach, or Passover, of course, for the Paschal offering, the lamb sacrificed and roasted in the days of the Bible and the Temple. Chag HaMatzot, the holiday of matzah, the unleavened bread we eat for the week of Passover. Chag HaAviv, the springtime festival, probably the oldest of the names for Passover. And most thematically, Zman Chirutenu, the season of our freedom. Each of these names is interesting in and of itself. The word Pesach itself comes from the word for leaping or jumping in Hebrew, an apt description of the ways young lambs leap and cavort in the fields. The use of this animal for the sacrifice of the Passover reminds us of the angel of death leaping over the homes of the Israelites when striking the firstborn of the Egyptians, and it refreshes for us the memory of the leaping joy of freedom, the ability to move and act as we wish that is prevented during slavery. Free people jump as they please. Slaves jump to someone else's command. Hence, Chag HaPesach, the holiday of, well, jumping. The second name for Passover is Chag HaMatzot, the festival of the poor man's bread, Lechem Oni, matzah. Unleavened bread made with flour and water in 18 minutes or less, baked quickly and simply. Food that our ancestors made as preparation for a hasty journey in flight. Of course, on Pesach we eat matzah all week, and therefore we do not eat chametz, which is best described as the opposite of matzah, anything made with leavening or fermentation. That means lots of matzah this coming week. Oh joy. The third name for the festival is Chag HaAviv, holiday of springtime. Undoubtedly, there was a spring festival observed long before the events of the Exodus led to the creation of Passover. Spring is celebrated in every culture and every religion. In our Seder celebrations, the orderly meals held the first two nights that teach the meaning and story of freedom in a wonderful variety of ways. Spring is featured in the green vegetables we dip in salt water and the hard-boiled egg that symbolizes the rebirth of spring, the most beautiful and verdant of seasons. And finally, the ultimate theme of Passover is freedom. Zman Chirutenu, the time of our liberation. It is this essential ideal that's woven through the week of Passover, central focus on God's gift of liberty that has made Pesach the model freedom festival for the world. In every generation, each of us is obligated to see ourselves as though we personally had been brought out of Egypt, we are taught in the Haggadah. In addition to celebrating our ancestors' liberation, we also are compelled to learn compassion and empathy for the downtrodden. For when we can view ourselves as survivors of slavery, we Jews must sympathize with the dispossessed. Whichever name of this fabulous festival you favor, may you be blessed with a Chag Sameach V'Kasher, a happy and healthy holiday of Passover beginning this Friday night. Play us in as part of our pre-Passover preview of Pesach music. Here's a personal favorite, the great cantor Moshe Oysher singing the conclusion of Chag Gadya, classic song from the end of the Seder, An Only Kid. Oh! That was the wonderful Moshe Osher singing Chad Gadya, the end of Seder song, coming near you this Friday night, March 30th, and Saturday night, March 31st. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is award-winning writer Tova Mervis, author of the extraordinary new memoir, The Book of Separation. She explores not only her leaving a long-term marriage, but also what it was like to leave Orthodoxy, in which she had lived her entire life. Hear her remarkable story when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Tova Mervis is the author of the new memoir, The Book of Separation, as well as three highly regarded novels, Visible City, The Outside World, and The Lady's Auxiliary, which was a national bestseller. She has written for a variety of newspapers and publications, both inside the Jewish world and very much outside of it. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you.
The Book of Separation is really an extraordinary book. It traces your journey really from Orthodoxy and from your marriage. Set it up for us. Tell us a little bit about how you decided to write this.
Sure. I mean, I really think of myself primarily as a novelist and love writing fiction where you get to explore other people's lives and other possibilities. But I wrote an essay about my Orthodox Jewish divorce ceremony, about getting a get and coming to know that I was leaving not just the marriage, but the religious world that had shaped me. And it was really one of the first times I'd written nonfiction. And the essay ended up being published in the New York Times. And in response to it, I received hundreds of emails from people, men and women, old and young, from all religious backgrounds, who were writing to share their own stories. And some were stories of divorce, and some were stories of religious change, but they were all stories, I think, of transformation or leave-taking of one kind or another. And it was really the most moving experience I've had as a writer. It made me realize that when you are willing to share a story that is makes you feel very vulnerable and exposed, it enables other people to connect. And so I decided to write the larger version of that essay, to write sort of the fuller story of what it means to be raised inside of a world and to get married at a young age and then decide, you know, nearing the age of 40, that world was not something that really matched who I was, the person I was becoming.
That's a very difficult choice for people to leave Orthodoxy, let alone a wife, a mother. That can't have been something you arrived at quickly.
No. I mean, I think any kind of life change like this is arrived at after much pain and deliberation and wrestling. I don't think anyone makes these choices lightly, and I certainly didn't. It was something that I wrestled with for decades, really, this question of what would it mean to leave, or what would it mean to not stay inside something that had really shaped every aspect of who I was. I think being part of an Orthodox Jewish world is not just something you do on the side, but it really encompasses the central part of your identity. And so for me, it was this sense of really reimagining who I was going to be in the world. And certainly as a mother of three children, it was made much more complicated because I knew that when you change, people around you change. You know, I think in families, we're always moving around each other and with each other. And so anytime one of us changes, there are ripple effects for everyone around you as well.
We will talk much more, but I feel like we're just beginning to scratch the surface with Tova Mervis, author of the new The Book of Separation, as well as three excellent novels, when we come back just a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOO Jewish Radio 18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as popular podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We're approaching the 70th birthday of the State of Israel, and as part of our build-up to this huge celebration, for the next few weeks, Two Jewish will include spots from both our Israeli Shinshinim and our Mivinah in Israel. And this morning, we have the added pleasure to introduce a brand new Maven on Israel. We welcome to Two Jewish for the very first time, so this is really a Shehechiano moment. Amir Eden, who is the new director of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Baruch Haba, and representing Israel in the community. Tell us about yourself a little bit.
Hi, Toda.
Thank
you very much. And Baruch HaNimtza. So I was born in Israel. I was raised there.
Where in Israel?
Where in Israel? Be'er Sheva.
Oh.
Be'er Sheva, the capital of the Negev.
The capital of the Negev.
It
they
is.
Used to have a camel market not that many years ago.
True, the Bedouin market. You're
yeah.
right. Yeah.
yeah.
So, well, it's a different city now.
It's
you
a big
come
city
and visit.
Now. It is very different. Absolutely.
So I was born there and did a regular Israeli experience of, you know, going to school and playing soccer and serving in the IDF, things like that. And then I came here when I was 26 years old to the United States for a honeymoon, got married in Israel, came here. I have an Israeli family, have an American family, so I came to visit my family and to tour their country. So, you know, we did what Israelis do when they come to the States, and many Americans don't, which is cover everything, right? New York and San Francisco and Miami and Washington and Mount Rushmore. So we did it all.
You saw Mount Rushmore. Very few Americans have gone that far north.
I know. It is beautiful, though.
It is beautiful.
For about an hour,
it's incredible. Yeah.
So, you know, through the years, I stayed here and I got a scholarship for both my bachelor's and my master's. So I went to Florida Atlantic University. I went to San Francisco State University. And through the time that I was here, I always worked for Israel, with the Jewish community, for the Jewish community. I love what I'm doing.
You've been an educator. You've run schools. You've worked representing a variety of different Israeli organizations. Tell us a little bit about those transitions.
Yeah, you're right. I'm a Jewish educator, and I served four Jewish day schools.
Only four?
So far, four. And my first one was Brandeis Little Day School. The other one was Donna Klein Jewish Academy. The third one was Jewish Schwartz in Scottsdale, here in Arizona. And the fourth one was the Adelson Educational Campus in Las Vegas. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say... You know, working as an educator, you're sure. working with all kinds of ages, but the truth is, most of what you're doing is explaining and teaching, mm-hmm. and that's really what the Israel Center does in so many important ways.
Right. So, I have to mention that beside, you know, serving as a Jewish educator, obviously I have experience outside of school. I established a student organization in Florida, four different universities. I established Israeli Scouts in Las Vegas. That's Tzofim.
Tzofim.
When I say I, obviously it's we, because you know everything you do is with a team.
In partnership.
Of course. And IAC, which is the Israeli American Council, I was the original director, the founder in Vegas. And that's working with agencies too. Going back to the Israel Center, Israel Center's role in the community is to work with all local partners and new partners and to strengthen the relationship between Tucson, Arizona, and Israel. So, yeah, you're right. It's educating. That's like the umbrella.
I'm looking forward to having the opportunity to get your insights on Israel and America and Israel, and especially the 70th birthday of Israel, which is coming up soon. Amir, we look forward to a long and warm relationship.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, and I want to thank you for the time, and I'm looking forward to working with you. Toda.
You're very welcome, Bavakasha. We'll talk next week. We welcome our Shinshinim on Israel, Tamir Shakuri and Chen Dinachi. Pesach is coming up. It's the holiday of ultimate preparations for Jews. Not all Jews are observant in Israel, of course. The vast majority of the population is considered chiloni, right? They're not religious. But that doesn't mean that you don't do some preparations for Pesach, for Passover. Tell us about your own experiences there.
It's true. My family is considered chilonit, considered secular. And we do celebrate the Jewish holidays. And Even though I think it's an excuse to make us all clean the house, my mom insists that every Pesach, we all like clean everything, clear our closets, clear everything in the kitchen, everything in the house, just throw away a bunch of stuff, like not throw away, give away, but and clean the whole thing. She bleaches everything she can, and just the house has to be spotless.
That is the smell in Israel for like 2-3 weeks before Pesach. Oh, is yeah. Bleach everywhere. Oh, yeah.
Definitely. Kill everything that's not absolutely clean. So my poor closet has to go through that. But also, like, I think although my family does eat chametz sometimes, we also make sure to like eat a lot of matzot and just kind of like get into the holiday spirit. And I think everyone in Israel, even if you don't necessarily feel religious, it's something inside you, that Judaism feeling, that Israeli united holiday feeling, that's just really cool and neat and unique.
And people are off of school too on Passover, right, on Pesach.
Of course, that's every kid's favorite holiday. It's almost 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks of no school. Who can ask for more?
In the spring, one of the nicest times of year. Tamir, tell us about Pesach and your Moshav and your experience.
It's most interesting to talk about Pesach in my school. In my school, every holiday is a big event, and Pesach is one of the biggest ones. We come together as a grade, so it's 11th grade, if I'm not mistaken, that are doing a Passover, or 10th grade. And you come together, you write a script, you make a full set for like a gigantic room, you make like advertisement, and it's just a very special feeling because it comes right before the holiday. So you want to work really hard because, you know, you can rest right after. And so Pesach is one of the biggest holidays that we really try to make the best play and the best set. And also
is it like, you know, dramatizing the Exodus from Egypt, or what do you dramatize in the play? The plagues, what do you do?
So every year we have a different topic. So let's say in my year, it was like Pesach from the dreams. So yeah, it was about someone who had a dream, and at some point it got into Exodus, but it was like a full comedy play. Mm-hmm. And it's like 40 minutes long. It's a really serious business right there. And I just think that right afterwards, when you're all done and you see the whole school really getting into the play and are excited to do their own play, then the year after, you go home and you rest and you get some time with your family for the Chagim. And like Chen said, the house is clean, so it's kind of a feeling of a new beginning. And it's kind of recharging you for the rest of the year.
It's a great, great experience. And as you guys have noted, so many of the Jewish holidays are focused on starting anew, starting afresh. Thanks so much, guys. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We are also exploring Israel's 70th anniversary, 310 years to be biblical about it, with a new Too Jewish feature, a look at each decade of Israel's existence from 1948 to 2018 through a headline from that year and a signature melody. And so this morning we continue this process of reviewing the history of the Jewish state, 70 years of Israel in 7 weeks. On to Decade 2 with a headline from 1958, more or less. We're going to fudge the specifics of the year a little bit this morning, since 1956 proved to be far more momentous than 1958, and more representative of the first decade of Israel's existence as a nation. But I'll include one event that took place in the year 1958 as well that did not make the headlines, but had important implications for the balance of power in the whole Middle East.
Autumn 1956. The eight-year-old armistice between Egypt and Israel, which had never blossomed into peace, flares up into war. Israel strikes swiftly across the Sinai Peninsula. The action precipitates the worldwide Suez Crisis. The Egyptians are completely routed. Once again, the Israelis had proved their strength in battle, this time led by General Dayan.
Our headline comes from the November 6, 1956 London Times. Allied forces take control of Suez. Gamal Abdel Nasser became the strongman military leader of Egypt by 1954. He stayed in that position until he died in 1970. And high on Nasser's agenda was ending the last vestiges of colonialism in Egypt. The Suez Canal was the crucial conduit for most of Europe's oil, and it played an important role in Britain and France moving troops around the world to trouble spots. Egypt was an independent nation, but the Suez Canal was still privately owned by British and French investors through the Suez Canal Company. By treaty, the canal was supposed to go to Egypt in 1968, but in July of 1956, Nasser suddenly nationalized the Suez Canal and closed it to all Israeli shipping. Egypt had closed the Straits of Tiran in 1950, and it also blockaded the Gulf of Aqaba, so Israel was now cut off from all shipping outside the Mediterranean. A major international crisis ensued. Both the U.S. and the USSR got involved, seeking Cold War influence in the Middle East. After nearly 4 months of tension and secret preparations, and in close coordination, on October 30, 1956, the Israeli army attacked across the Gaza Strip and captured the Sinai Peninsula, while British and French military units quickly captured the Suez Canal. Canal shipping was blocked, however, by ships Egypt sunk before being driven back. The U.S., under President Eisenhower, saw the war as old-fashioned colonialism, and it was also afraid of direct Russian intervention. With the UN, America pressured the Allies, Britain, France, and Israel, to withdraw from Egypt. The Suez Crisis and the war ended with the humiliation of Britain and France. Great Britain was no longer a world power and never regained the capacity to act like one. France, too, found itself again holding the short end of the stick in the aftermath of a colonial war. A new Cold War reality in the Middle East set in, with Russia and the U.S. vying for allies and influence. Israel held the Sinai until March of 1957, when it withdrew. In a way, the 10-year-old country had the best results from the war, since Israel's military proved to be the strongest in the Middle East, and its performance surpassed that of its advanced allies, Britain and France. The headline that wasn't run came in 1958. France helped Israel build the Negev Nuclear Research Center then, 10 miles from the small town of Dimona, and Israel's never-acknowledged nuclear weapons program began. In just 5 years, by 1963, Israel had a working nuclear reactor and then produced nuclear weapons by the Six-Day War. It was the secret work conducted at Dimona that guaranteed Israel's preeminence and power in the Middle East. Our song from 1958 is the still popular love song Erev Shel Shoshanim, sung by the Dudaim then and still used today, 60 years later, at Jewish weddings.
Erev Shel Shoshanim Netzen la'el habustan Mor besamim eulev hona Leragelech miftan Erev shel shoshanim Netzenna el habustan Mor besamim eulev hona Leragelech miftan Laila yored lehat Veruach shoshanin oshiva Havahelcha shelach shire balat Zemmer shel ahava Lara yored lehat Veruach shoshanin oshiva Havahelcha shelach shire balat Zemmer shel ahava.
That was our second weekly Two Jewish Celebration, 70 Years of Israel in 7 weeks, a memory from the headlines of 1956 and 1958. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You are off to Georgia, and I do not mean Atlanta.
The Peachtree State, no, right.
Tell us about Georgia, the Jewish community of Georgia, formerly a Soviet republic.
Right.
Interesting, so, and complicated place.
Yes, and in the category of wandering Jew, I first went to Georgia years and years ago when it was still part of the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union was still ruled by Brezhnev in the 70s. On my way home from my infamous trip of hitchhiking across Asia to the south of India and going to Afghanistan and Iran when the Shah was still on the peacock throne and all that. And Georgia was just about my favorite place in the whole former Soviet Union, in large part because the food was way better. It definitely had the best food. So you always looked in Moscow or St. Petersburg, or whatever, for a Georgian restaurant. And even today, like in Kyiv, you look for a Georgian restaurant because the food is just spectacular. They also have a great wine scene and arguably produce still, long after the demise of the Soviet Union, the best wine in the entire post-Soviet space. But the reason I'm going now has to do a little bit with the Jewish community. There are very strong ties between Georgia and Israel. When I was there, it was the place where the Jewish community was freest to live overtly as Jews and celebrate their Jewishness and have bar mitzvahs and weddings and all that stuff. And of course, even though we were only in the country 3 or 4 days, we got invited to several families and ate kosher food in their homes and whatever. It was a very warm welcome. So I have very good memories of that. But right now, one of my best friends from all my years as a diplomat is a Turkish woman who spent most of the past 5 years being in charge of counterterrorism in the foreign ministry of Ankara.
Wow.
So she worked like 24/7. You know, she worked all those coup attempts and the terrorist incident at the Istanbul airport and lots of international conferences on how to combat terrorism and, you know, just like traveling all the time and hardly ever seeing her children, whatever. She's a very dedicated, very competent, multilingual woman who was at quite a young age the number two in the Turkish embassy in Moscow, which is a hugely important embassy for them. And she finally got her reward. She's been probably 3 months now out in Tbilisi as ambassador, and she will be my host, and I'll get to see the ambassador's residence and the ambassador's limo and the ambassador's driver and all that stuff. And presumably also we'll do some tours of wineries and some great restaurants. And this woman has a Jewish grandmother from Thessaloniki. So we will probably visit some Jewish community center and or synagogue or whatever points of Jewish interest, because she knows me quite well and she knows what my interests are.
You know, it's fascinating that people think about the former Soviet Union as sort of, you know, one place. Boy, is that not true. And while there are certain commonalities, some of the republics today are so different, have changed so dramatically. It'd be interesting to see what the Jewish community is really like there now.
Right. I mean, the only thing that was ever the same throughout the Soviet Union, fairly standardized, airports and train stations, which looked the same. They looked like these neoclassical buildings with fake Greek columns. And the airports looked like train stations placed on the outskirts of a city. And wherever you went in the former Soviet Union, they were remarkably similar. Well, that's all changed. They've torn down most of those old airports. They've built new ones reflecting local design tastes and regional influence. So in the Baltic states, they look very Scandinavian. And in Central Asia, they look very Central Asian. That's quite an interesting evolution since the end of the Soviet Union.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing about it. Thanks so much, Tom.
Bye.
We welcome our Mivi Na'an Israel, Oshrat Bar-El, head of the Weintraub Israel Center, and a regular guest of Two Jewish Now for, well, I guess since like the 65th anniversary of Israel nearly. We're about to celebrate the 70th anniversary. You're the longest standing Israel expert in the history of Two Jewish, which is now in our 16th year, we're now in our 16th year. So some early thoughts on Israel's 70th birthday. It's such a huge celebration coming up next month. And it'll be celebrated, I'm sure, for weeks and weeks, because that's how we do these things. What are your first thoughts about, you know, Israel becoming 70?
Whoa. I think on a personal level, as an Israeli who lives outside of Israel, you know, for almost 5 years, definitely it's a different perspective. And I'm truly like proud of everything that Israel, on one hand, I'm really proud of everything that Israel has been able to achieve in 70 years, but mainly in the past few years, when it's mainly when it relates to technology and how Israel really playing such an important role in the world, you know, improving, making the world literally a better place to live, you know. If one will know how many innovations, Israeli innovations he use on a daily basis, I think he will be impressed the same that we are. That's on one level. I'm also impressed of our ability as a nation to maintain crazy but democracy, you know, in this crazy.
Well, democracy is a little crazy, isn't it?
Yes, I agree.
In its best form.
And not just in the Middle East, but in these crazy times that we are facing now.
Absolutely.
It's not easy, as we can see. It's bumpy. It's very bumpy. But I'm also proud that we are able to, you know, stay democratic state and, in a way, sane. On the other hand, I'm still struggling with many other parts of Israel, and if I can wish on Israel birthday, you know, wishes for the next 70 years or for the next 7 minutes, is really for more, you know, in general, more equality or more. That's the right
shivyon,
but
equality,
in general, may we see each other as a human beings. I know it's a lot to ask, but you need to ask it, you know, because it will solve so many of our problems if we will be able to see each other as a human being. And it relates to an earlier conversation of us about, you know. So that's what I wish in general. And but being realistic, I just wish that we will, that our leaders, because I understand that the conflict is not between the people. That's unfortunately between the politicians. So
imagine that, conflicts between politicians.
Yeah, can you imagine?
Could never happen in the United States of America, yes. Only in Israel.
So I really wish that more and more people, and you can see it, and this is a beautiful trend in Israel, you can see more and more people that are like, enough. We want to communicate. There is a lot to gain out of this communication than to lose. So I hope that more we will see more and more of this initiative and won't be like so rare like in the past. And maybe this will change the language in Israel and in the Middle East and who knows in the world.
You know, one of the things that I always think about in terms of Israel is the word resiliency, the ability to just bounce back through anything and continue on in what has been an incredible journey. You know, Israel's not perfect, just like every other country in the world is not perfect. Mm-hmm. And yet it has come through so much and is at such an extraordinary place right now. Oshrat, thank you so much.
Toda rabba, rabbi.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. With Passover less than a week away, the Jewish community in Madrid was desperate. There was an acute shortage of beet horseradish, the key ingredients in that fiery condiment for gefilte fish known as chrein. A cry arose, and the whole community was mobilized in an effort to prevent this shanda, this tragedy. All the European Union countries gave the same reply, "Sorry, we have none." In desperation, the rabbi in Madrid phoned a yeshiva friend in Tel Aviv and begged him to send a crate of horseradish by air freight to Madrid. 2 days before Passover, a crate of grade A tear-jerking Israeli horseradish was loaded at Ben Gurion onto an El Al flight to Madrid, and all seemed well. Unfortunately, when the rabbi went to the Madrid airport to claim the horseradish, a wildcat strike had broken out, and no shipments could be unloaded for a week. He was able to get a few ounces, but not nearly enough for all the Spanish Jews. As a sad result, you guessed it, the chrein in Spain stayed mainly on the plane. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Don't forget to get your chrein before Pesach. And now a word of Torah. This week's portions are chosen especially for the holiday of Passover, which begins Friday night. In addition to the usual suspects for Torah readings for Pesach, the last of the 10 plagues, the Passover sacrifice, crossing of the Sea of Reeds, washing away of the Egyptian army and chariots, Moses' great song at the sea, we also chant the beautiful and unusual biblical book, the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim, on the Sabbath of Passover. Normally, the Song of Songs is chanted on the Shabbat that falls in the middle of Passover, Shabbat Chol HaMoed Pesach. Since this year, Passover begins Friday night and ends either the following Friday night, if you're Reform, or the following Saturday night, if you're Orthodox or Conservative, there is no intermediate Sabbath, and so Reform Jews sing the Song of Songs this Saturday, and Orthodox and Conservative Jews will chant Song of Songs a week from Saturday. It is the ultimate love poem of the Bible, a beautiful and complex hymn to human physical love unequaled in Western religious literature. Shir HaShirim Asher Li Shlomo, the Song of Songs which is Solomon's, kiss me with the kisses of your mouth, it begins, and then it gets really hot. It is a nearly postmodern text in that the voice changes with every chapter, and within every chapter, you aren't always sure who's speaking. One man, a woman, two women. And you aren't always sure to whom the gorgeous love poetry is addressed. It's a rich, swirling tapestry of love and desire. A perfect text for the springtime of the year when our hearts turn to thoughts of love and life renewed. What a great and sexy gift from the Jewish tradition at this verdant time of year. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, award-winning novelist Tova Mervis, will explain what she lost and what she gained by leaving Orthodoxy and a long-term marriage, and how she wrote it into her new work, The Book of Separation. Hear about it when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Jewish Agency Chairman Natan Sharansky will be awarded the Israel Prize for Aliyah and the Ingathering of Exiles, Israeli Education Minister Naftali Bennett announced last week. Sharansky is the story of Israel, he said. Anatoly Sharansky sat as a prisoner of Zion in a Soviet jail for almost a decade. He became a symbol for all those in prison, wanting to live as free and proud Jews and for their hope to make Aliyah to Israel. Anatoly Sharansky was born in 1948 in Donetsk, Ukraine. Upon completing his studies in computer science in Moscow, he applied for a visa to Israel, which was denied for security reasons. In 1977, Sharansky was imprisoned by the Soviet Union for his struggle for Jewish life and the right for Jewish immigration to Israel. He became the most prominent refusenik of all. He was finally released by Russia in 1986 after 9 years in Soviet prison and immigrated to Israel, choosing to use his first name in Hebrew, Natan, thereafter.
They called me Anatol, in prison I did lie. My little window looked out on a Russian sky. For nearly 9 long years, secluded and in pain. And all my people know the charges were a frame. See my accuser standing in the hall. He points his finger at us all. You now must pay the penalty for the crime of daring to be free. We are leaving Mother Russia. We have waited.
Sharansky's wife Avital immigrated to Israel prior to his arrest and fought for his release. Bennett noted that Avital is also a symbol for Jewish sacrifice and heroism. This is a great honor and a great responsibility, Sharansky said. When it comes to Kibbutz Galuyot, the ingathering of the exiles, the Israel Prize also goes to Avital and to all the Aliyah activists and prisoners of Zion in the Soviet Union who fought valiantly for the right to immigrate to Israel. It also goes to the whole Jewish people, which supported the Refuseniks' struggle for freedom. The ingathering of the exiles continues. Aliyah today is an Aliyah of free choice. Israel is the best place for self-actualization as a Jew, and for impacting the future of the Jewish people, we must do everything to ensure that Israel remains a home to every Jew in the world. The Israel Prize is the state's highest honor. It's presented annually on Independence Day, Yom HaTzma'ut, in a state ceremony in Jerusalem, in the presence of the President, the Prime Minister, the Knesset Speaker, and the Supreme Court President. In other news, last week, in a dramatic break with Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, Ronald Lauder, president of the World Jewish Congress, said Israeli government policies threaten the country's democratic character and even its existence. In a public editorial, Lauder pressed hard for a two-state solution, a significant stance because the cosmetics billionaire has the ear of President Donald Trump, who is about to unveil a Middle East peace proposal. Trump has said he is agnostic about whether two states is the preferred outcome for Israel and the Palestinians, and over the past year, Netanyahu has retreated from endorsing a two-state solution. Much of Lauder's column was an excoriation of Netanyahu's policy in terms more commonly heard on the pro-Israel left. What made the statement notable is that Lauder is a very prominent conservative who has taken right-wing positions on Israel. The Jewish democratic state faces two grave threats I believe could endanger its very existence, Lauder said. The first is the possible demise of the two-state solution. I am conservative and a Republican, and I have supported the Likud party since the 1980s. But the reality is 13 million people live between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, and almost half of them are Palestinian. Lauder chided Netanyahu for his repeated claims that the only thing obstructing peace is Palestinian recalcitrance. President Trump and his team are wholly committed to Middle East peace, Lauder said. Contrary to news media reports, senior Palestinian leaders are, they've personally told me, ready to begin direct negotiations immediately. Ron Lauder also objects to the control that the Orthodox in Israel have over a range of issues, including marriage and organized prayer at the Western Wall, Kotel. By submitting to the pressure exerted by a minority in Israel, the Jewish state is alienating a large segment of the Jewish people, he said. This crisis is especially pronounced among the younger generation, which is predominantly secular. Lauder has been close to Netanyahu for decades, backing him during his first run for prime minister back in 1996 and defending him in the diaspora. Over the past several years, Lauder and Netanyahu have grown apart. From Lauder's refusal 7 years ago to block an unflattering report on Netanyahu and his wife Sarah broadcast on an Israeli TV channel in which Lauder was a part owner. Lauder, chairman emeritus of the Estee Lauder Cosmetics Empire and president of the World Jewish Congress since 2007, has also been one of the most consistent voices of support for Trump in the Jewish community. The two have been friends since the 80s when they both emerged as influential moguls on the New York political and social scenes. And in Latin America, a Jewish television journalist in Colombia was ordered to resign from her anchor post on a daily TV newscast when she refused to cross herself while on the air. Channel One's Kathy Beckerman was asked to resign after refusing the order by Yamid Amat, newscast director of the CMN broadcast network. He told me to cross myself. I did not do it. He asked me to resign at that moment, to which I did not agree, Beckerman told Colombian media. The case came to light after radio journalist Azuri Chama, who is Jewish, tweeted about it. According to Graciela Torres, another well-known Colombian journalist, Beckerman showed up in the newsroom 2 days after the March 14th incident, escorted by her father and a lawyer. It's a dark situation for Yamid Amat and his newscast because they could be sued for religious intolerance in a country where there is freedom of worship, Torres said. We expect a public apology from Mr. Amat in light of his discriminatory behavior of freedom of religion guaranteed by the Colombian Constitution, said the Confederation of Jewish Communities of Colombia, the country's Jewish umbrella organization. Amat eventually published an apology on Channel One's website. Beckerman accepted the apology and is ready to talk again about her return to TV in Colombia. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Tova Mervis is the author of the new, I guess, memoir, The Book of Separation, about leaving her marriage and leaving Orthodoxy. She's the author previously of three excellent and well-reviewed novels, including the national bestseller, The Ladies' Auxiliary. Your background becomes an important part of all this, right? You're used to writing novels. You're used to creating characters. This one is you. How did it feel?
It definitely felt very different. I mean, when I first set out to write the memoir, there were so many times I would set up my computer to write and think, why am I doing this? Why not take this material and transform it into fiction? And I mean, it is what I love about fiction. You know, you can start with parts of your life or start with true pieces, but it's always a process of transformation. And I think for the writer, certainly when I wrote, for me writing my novels, I had that sense that I was able to hide inside the material. It was always, you know, I might have a character that wrestled with Orthodoxy or a character who was struggling inside a marriage, but there's always that part of me that would say, no, it's not me. It's just this character. And it gives you that distance. And then writing memoir, there's not that place to hide. There's the agreement with the reader that this is me. And of course, you know, it's not every part of me. It's not my diary. You shape a story still, and parts are left out for privacy or for other people. But it is you on the page. And so it really was a challenge to become comfortable with the fact of telling, you know, not other character stories, but telling my own story.
You talk about, you know, being able to create transformation in character. Well, I mean, this is real transformation in real life.
Right. I mean, something that people always say, sometimes life gives us the best stories, or some of the things I was writing, I felt like, oh, it sounds like I'm making this up. There were certain details, you know, right around the time that my marriage was sort of collapsing, the diamond for my engagement ring fell out. And that was true. It happened. But I knew that if that was in a novel,
you'd
that
sound
would be the kind
too
of detail,
fake, right?
Too fake. I was like, oh, of course that's not true. You're making that up. And yet it did happen. It really did happen that way. And there's that strangeness of realizing that sometimes life fits together more, offers us those moments in a way that you wouldn't believe them in fiction.
It's so funny that you say that. In my first marriage, my wife lost her engagement ring in the ocean. And instead of replacing it, she just wanted to keep the insurance money. And I thought, that's probably not a good sign somehow.
Not a good sign. Right, exactly.
You've experienced Judaism in a very different way. It almost feels like, you know, somebody is Orthodox, they stop becoming religious. There's a perception in the Orthodox community that they've left religion, they've lost it. Tell us about your experience of that and how you perceive your Judaism now.
Right. I think there is an attitude from some in the Orthodox community that if you leave Orthodoxy, you do so because, oh, you just wanted to taste the forbidden fruits, as people have said, or you just wanted to rebel. There's not the sense that you could have engaged in a serious sense of grappling and that belief matters. I think that a lot of times in the Orthodox world, belief is not talked about. It's sort of the assumption or the premise upon which everything else rests. But I think there is the feeling sometimes that, well, I might not believe exactly, but as long as I observe, then I can stay within. And I know that very well. I mean, I lived that for a long time. But I do think belief matters. I think it matters what you believe to be actually true. And so for me, that question ran through everything. I mean, I could observe. I can keep a kosher kitchen with my eyes closed. But if I doubted the truth upon which that rested, it didn't matter. It didn't mean as much as it needed to. And part of leaving, I think, is, you know, leaving is not an easier path to take. Leaving is a harder path because, first of all, leaving is hard. Leaving requires you to let go of so many of the structures of your life. But even more so, leaving requires you to begin to answer the question of, well, what then do I believe? If I don't believe that, what does give meaning and purpose to my life? What is my connection to Judaism? If it's not just following along the thing that I was born into, well, what do I want it to look like? And I think that you can leave something without leaving every part of it. And it requires a sifting process, maybe, or a reevaluation, but deciding that I do still feel very connected to the Jewish world and to Jewish tradition and Jewish holidays and Jewish history, but it was not going to look the same. But it doesn't require you to let go of everything, but you get to choose. No one gets to say to you, you're in or you're out. You get to make that decision for yourself of what your relationship will be.
So a chutzpahdik question. Some people must have said this. Was this just a midlife crisis?
Right, sure. People say all sorts of things. You know, I guess
don't they?
I could give you a list. But
yeah. No,
I guess
I've been there.
I guess okay. I guess it was just a midlife crisis. I guess I would have to say, well, what does that mean? Just, you know, what midlife crisis? As if, oh, it's not serious, right? It's just a crisis. It's just happening in your midlife. I feel like, no, it is a midlife crisis in the real sense. It's saying, I'm almost 40 and I feel like I'm not allowed to believe what I really believe. I'm not allowed to say what I actually think, and I'm not allowed to feel what I actually feel. I'm like, yes, that is a crisis. And I think that idea, you know, people I think always want to diminish those changes that they don't believe in, or people always want to find a way to put down something that threatens them. And I think one of the things I've learned is not to listen to those voices, because I think since the book has come out, I've gotten, you know, hundreds and hundreds of emails from people who are having, you know, just their own midlife crisis. And the letters are filled with pain and hope and desire for something to look different and a recognition of coming to an end of where they are now and a need for something else. And I think it's part of the universal human experience, that sense that attempt that I need to reevaluate, or that awareness that comes maybe when we're young, before midlife, you don't have the perspective or you don't have the urgency, maybe the recognition of, if I don't live my authentic life now, you know, when do I? When I'm 50, when I'm 60, at what age are you allowed to become yourself?
It's a great answer. A last question, brief. Have any of the people who were important to you in your Orthodox life responded positively? What do you think the proportion is?
Well, my immediate family has been wonderful. I think that, you know, I think for any parent who not only watches a daughter change and then learns that daughter is going to write a book about it, I think that's much. But my parents have really been amazing in terms of their understanding of, really, I learned what I want to teach my kids. In so many ways, I feel like I've learned from my parents that sense that you raise your kids and you teach them and you try to instill things in them, but ultimately they become adults and they become themselves. And I feel like my parents have been supportive, and my siblings as well. In the larger Orthodox world, you know, it's mixed. You never know what responses you get. And I learned this with my first novel, The Ladies Auxiliary, which is about the Orthodox community in Memphis.
In Memphis, and where your family is from originally.
My whole family is from. I'm a sixth generation Memphian.
Right.
And my family, you know, is still lives there. And, you know, people who read my first novel, there were people who loved it and there were people who hated it. And they were reading the same book, and it was fascinating. And I learned it really by trial by fire as a young writer, that the things we react to, the books that make us angry or the books we love, say as much about ourselves as they do about the book. And so people who are angry, it says as much about who they are in the world and their own wishes or needs as it does about my choices. And I've learned to accept that fact, that everyone will respond differently. And then there have been many, many, many people in the Orthodox world who've written to me, some of whom have left the world and some of whom are in that in-between place of questioning and struggle.
I want to thank Tova Mervis for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called The Book of Separation. You can get it, of course, on Amazon, where all books are sold. And you can find out more about her on tovamervis.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest will be Rachel Laser, the new executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Passover preview of Pesach music, Adir Hu, for the Seder, coming this Friday night. My friends, may you have a Chag Sameach v'Kasher, a Zisen Pesach, a happy coming festival of freedom, and a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Adir hu, adir hu, yiven beito bekarov, bimhera, bimhera, beyaminu bekarov, el bene, bene beitcha bekarov, bimhera, bimhera, beyaminu bekarov. Adir hu, adir hu, yiven beito bekarov, bimhera, bimhera, beyaminu bekarov, el bene, bene beitcha bekarov, bimhera, bimhera, beyaminu bekarov.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.